Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I'm an author, a speaker, and a frequent columnist for LinkedIn and the Harvard Business Review. In my book, Disrupt Yourself, I set forth a framework for putting disruptive innovation to work. Because I can't get enough of these ideas, I'm continually on the hunt for people who are living disruption out loud. Cos Marte is one of these individuals. He's an ex-convict and a small business owner. Cos's story starts on New York City's Lower East Side, where he sold drugs as a teenager. Managing a drug dealing operation made him a lot of money in his teens and 20s. That's when he wasn't behind bars. From ages 15 to 27, he did three stints in jail for a total of 6 years. When he finally got out, Cos was determined to turn his life around. He started a fitness studio called Con Body on the same street corner in his old neighborhood where he once dealt drugs. Cos hires people like him who have spent time in jail who are also looking for a second chance. Let's get right to it. What was one of the most disruptive things that you did as a child?
I got involved with at an early age selling drugs and dealing with drugs right on this corner. And at 11, I started, you know, smoking and dealing. And 13, I got actually arrested for my first case. And from there, just quickly started progressing. And I got arrested 10 times between the ages of 13 to 23.
That's pretty disruptive.
Yeah.
So the ages of 13 to 23. And did you ever end up going to prison for that?
Yeah. So I served a total of 6 years in prison. Mm-hmm. First time I went to was juvie from 15 to 16, and then from 19 to 20, and then 23 to 27.
Were you ever scared?
I was. There's always a frightening sense, and you always have some type of fear, but it just became normal for me. You know, when the cops would stop me, I would get stopped probably like two or three times a day.
A day.
Literally every day the cops would mess with me.
Because they knew you were dealing drugs.
They knew I was dealing. They knew we was just hanging on the corner, thinking of doing some stupid stuff. And they would just throw us on a wall and just like start searching us, and then wouldn't find anything and just, you know, keep going. Or we used to drive around and make noise, and they used to pull us over, take us out of the car, like every single day. And it just became normal. It was like, oh, you know,
here we go.
The police is stopping us again, and we have a stash bot. They wouldn't find stuff. And then eventually, you know, they found stuff. I mean, they started an investigation with us for a few years. And so I grew out a whole drug business as a kid at 16, 17. I took over the corner of Eldridge and Broome. And I changed the way we sold drugs. I had everybody that was, like, dealing drugs with us, you know, wear suits, ties, look like regular business people. And we were not getting stopped after that. We stopped like hanging out in the corner.
Oh, that's interesting. So when you changed how you dressed,
yeah,
people stopped stopping you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it grew out to a huge organization, and we quickly started making lots and lots of money. I made 10,000 business cards, and I gave it out to everyone who looked at that like they were using at the time, and it quickly expanded. And by the age of 19, I was making $2 million a year.
All just in this neighborhood?
No, it started off in this neighborhood, yeah. And then it just started, once I started doing the card business and expanding it that way, it just started growing like crazy. And we started doing deliveries, and I had a dispatcher who was like sitting in a condo in Midtown, and he was dispatching a couple people in the area, and then it just quickly began, and we had over 20 cars running around. It's from really the whole tri-state area.
As a 19-year-old?
Yep.
It's very impressive. So how did you finally get caught?
So I had these workers who was delivering for me, and one of them, actually the dispatcher who was like dispatching people, we had 7 cell phones because each phone only held 1,500 numbers. Mm-hmm. So he began another phone behind our back, and he started stealing customers away and started using one of my drivers to like deliver his work on the side, and people started complaining because it was not the same thing and or whatever. And I found it fishy, and some of the clients that knew me from early on had my personal number, and they contacted me, and it was like, what's going on? Don't send that guy with the, you know, green truck anymore, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, all right. So I started fishing around, and I found out that he was stealing the customers, and I got him out of the service, and I took that phone away from him, and I started dispatching everything and doing everything myself, but not knowing that that phone that he had and stealing those customers, it wound it up in federal agents' hands, and he was dealing to federal agents.
Did he know he was dealing to federal agents?
He did not know that he was dealing with federal agents.
So he got sloppy, and then you got stung.
Yeah, and he didn't get caught. So I started sending everybody, all my guys, to detectives and federal agents, and it just be quickly. They had around 40 sales on us. Mm-hmm. Direct sales, and so that's all they had on us was just like 40 minor sales. They were always asking for something bigger, but we didn't sell, so it's something big. I was just like getting lots of drugs and just breaking it down into minute sizes, whatever. And we just doing our services like that. And then one of my guys, when they first like started, when the day that they started capturing anybody, the guy that first got caught was my barber, who actually is still around here. But he just started telling them everything. Mm. They gave him a deal, and they said, if you tell us where everything is, where the stash house, where his car's at, we'll let you out scot-free.
So he took the deal.
And he took the deal, and he began, like, they tapped my phone, and they started going after everybody that was so that day I was dispatching. I was in the Bronx in this stash house I had out there, and I'm sending all my workers to delivery points, and one at a time they were getting caught. And those old next cell phones, walkie talkies. So I was like sending them through the walkie talkies, and when it goes bing and it gets like stuck, that was happening all day. And I'm like, this is so funny. And I thought it was like a technical problem that was happening. And I was like, all right, whatever. So I'm going to go like make the deliveries myself, because I had a list of like 30, 40 people. So I had an easel with like the people that were calling and where the person was, on that corner. So yeah, I wrote out like in a notepad, I just copied the whole list, and I said I was going to go out, and I, took a good amount of drugs, to go make the delivery. And as soon as I step out of the house, the stash house in the Bronx, this guy, looks at me, and I look at him, and I go, I had a BMW, and I open up my car, and he's like, this is DEA agent Joseph King. Your whole operation is over. I thought it was bullshit. I thought it was like, because he was by himself. I'm like, get the fuck out of here. What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
I like turn around on him, and as soon as I turn around, just a whole bunch of federal agents just like jumped on me. They had a warrant for the house. They came in and ran into the house and found,
everything.
They took me. They actually took me up to the second floor of the house where I had the stash hat at. And they asked me, where are the drugs? And I was like, what are you talking about? I don't have anything. They knew exactly where it was. Mm-hmm. And that's when I knew somebody told. Mm-hmm. And I knew who told, because only like two other people knew where that stash was. So
So now you're 22 years old.
23 at that time.
23 at this point. You've had a number of people who have betrayed you. How have you dealt with that as you've moved forward? Because we have to forgive to move forward. How have you dealt with that?
Right now, I feel like everything happened for a reason. Mm-hmm. At that point, I was like trying to be vindictive, and like I felt really, really bad. And we were all, when we got to the precinct, and we all saw each other in the precinct, and I was telling the guy, the barber who told on us, I was like, "You didn't say shit, did you?" I was like confronting him, and he's like, "No, I swear to God, this and that." Mm-hmm. He started crying, and he was like, "I need to go home and see my son and stuff like that." And I was like, "Don't worry, I'm gonna try to take the rap for everybody." And when they, you know, one by one, they started, you know, interrogating us, and the DA was already in the precinct, and they asked me, you know, "Are you gonna talk? Let us know." And I was like, I just cursed them out, and mm-hmm. was like, "You know what? Like, I don't care about this. Give me whatever you need to give me." It was like, "You know, you're facing 12 to 24 years." I was like, "So give me 25, and let all my friends go. And I started this, and I'm gonna end this." Mm-hmm. So,
what were you like when you got to prison in terms of your physical health? What were you like once you got there?
I was mad. I was sad, but I was not really. I was not depressed, and I was not extremely mad. It was just like, I was expecting this, and I'm just going to face it. And when I get there, I'm in jail. I was in jail for about a year in Rikers Island fighting my case. And while I'm in Rikers Island, I was like doing weed, drinking, and just basically
prison?
Yeah. I was smoking so much weed and just hustling and everything. But then, and this is not prison, this is jail. The difference between jail and prison, jail is where you're going to be held at until you're convicted, and then you're sentenced to prison. So I was in jail for about a year, and in jail, they don't really check you medically. So I didn't find out I had health issues until I went, and that was the property of the state. And once I went upstate, and you're sentenced, that's when you see real doctors. And they took all my medical examinations, and they told me my cholesterol levels are so high that I could have, you know, died of a heart attack within 5 years.
So what did you do?
I started working out, and I went as soon as I came out of that medical office, and the doctors told me that, I went back to my cell. And I started like trying to do dips on the side of my bed. And I was like, I'm not going to die in this place. Like, I need to get out and like see my son.
How old was your son at this point?
He was 2.
Young.
About to be 3, yeah. And I was just doing like jumping jacks and stuff like that. And then once I was really out of that cell and out to the prison yard, I started running. I started running every single day. I was running the first day I probably ran like a lap or two, and then just walking, and then it quickly started progressing. Eventually I lost 70 pounds in 6 months, and I was running for about 2 hours straight a day.
So the motivating force for this was, I am going to get out of prison alive.
Yeah.
Because I want to see my son.
Yeah. And then it became like a culture while I was there, because I started a whole group, and I lost all that weight. And when I was running the yard, some guy who was pretty overweight, he's like, "I want to work out with you, I want to start running the yard." And he came up to me, and then we started running in the yard, and I was training him, and then eventually we started a whole group. We would form a whole circle. I would be in the middle, and we would train. And then I helped over 20 guys. It was over 1,000 pounds combined.
It's really impressive. Yeah. One of the things that people say when they want to do something new is they don't know what their transferable skills are. Yeah. So you were a drug dealer. Then you go to prison. Now you're out of prison. How did you figure out what your transferable skills are?
So what I do today, I founded Combody. And what we, our whole mission is to hire formerly incarcerated people. And we have this space here where they train at, and we also do stuff outside. We're doing stuff virtually online where we're going to be introducing like a online workout videos, which we launched this week and had almost 2,000 people sign up already in a couple of days.
Congratulations.
And from like 20 different countries. And it's just been an amazing response. It's been crazy. But it's been a blessing. And I feel like my transferable skills, I was always an asker, and I was always like, you know, holding people accountable to do it, you know, like close the deal, like right there and then.
So when you say you've always been an asker, tell me what you mean by that.
My mom, you know, always told me, if you don't ask, you don't eat. And my mom is a hustler too. If she's like the number one promoter, and she's like, she'll get people to sign up right on the spot too.
For your gym.
Yeah. she was like that when we were growing up. She was not scared of like starting a conversation next to somebody on a train. And it was just like always interacting and networking, and she would exchange numbers and follow up. And I guess I learned stuff from her.
She modeled that for you, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So what about the business skills?
The business skills, it comes from like dealing with people, mm-hmm. and managing people, and knowing that not everybody's going to be like me. Mm-hmm. And I can't duplicate myself, but I could try my best to teach them how to do something. I was running like 40 classes a week myself. I was like, you know, managing everything. And they're like, you know, how are you going to get this duplicated? How are you going to grow this? And I'm like, don't worry. Like, it's going to take time, but I'm going to make it happen. Eventually, when, you know, we started generating more cash, I got somebody else. They were not perfect, but now they're amazing. And it just took them time to learn and get situated. So, and then it takes a lot of managing, like dealing with like HR, like when people
but
start.
But that's a transferable skill, right?
Yeah.
Because before, when you had a $2 million business, how many people did you have reporting to you?
Yeah, we had like 23 people, and there was sometimes that, you know, people got jealous. It was like, why are you sending this guy to more spots? And you know, me, I need this and that. And it's like, not everybody's going to be happy. And there's some people that are going to be happier than others. And it's just knowing that everybody's different.
So you led, you managed, and then when you were in prison, you clearly were a leader, because you would start working out, and then you had a group of how many people did you say? 20?
Yeah. Well, it was like off and on a little bit over 20. So when I started, it was like 11, 12 people. And then I went to switch over to another prison, and I started the same thing there.
And then how many people do you have working for you now?
It's 14 of us.
14. And growing.
And growing fast.
What's your proudest moment as a developer of talent?
I'm really, really proud of Sultan Malik, who's a senior trainer here. And he's amazing. He's changed a lot. And he tells me he changed because of me a little bit, but I don't think so. I think he was just like really hungry and really, you know, appreciative that he had an opportunity. And he took full advantage of it.
When did he start, and what's he doing now? Give us an idea of his trajectory.
Yeah, he's our senior trainer. He's making pretty good money. And he's been home for only 2 years, a little bit over 2 years. And he started with us like almost as soon as he came out, probably like 3 months, 4 months as when he came out.
How did you find him?
I was working at a nonprofit organization, and I was helping people that were on public assistance find employment. And I was typing up resumes for them. And a lot of people that get out of prison, they automatically go into the welfare system and receive public assistance. So Sultan was in this public assistance program, and I was running the resume lab, and I had a coworker there that he went approached, and he told her like that he wanted to be an instructor, a fitness instructor, that he was working out with like a few ladies in the park, and he was hustling out there. He was making okay money, but he wanted to start, pursue that business or that career. And she quickly, he was like, "Yo, I was just released from doing 14 years in prison." And she was like, "What? You need to speak to my coworker." So she like brought him over and sat down. He sat down on my desk, and he began talking to me. And he was like, "She told me to come talk to you. I don't know why." And I was like, "Oh, what's up?" So he started telling me about this, and then I slipped him my card on the side. I was like, come check out what I'm doing after work." And the next day he shows up, and I already had like 25 people that I was training in a class, and he was like, "Oh my God, I want to be a part of this." So I got him involved right away.
And that's fantastic.
Yeah. Right now I got like 10 stories like that, but it's just been amazing. It's been amazing.
So gratifying, I bet.
Yeah. And it changes and how much they learn, etiquette skills, adapt, how to adapt right back to society and interact with different type of people, because they're still living in some of the worst neighborhoods in the city. And then also learning the technology, like Sultan came home and he didn't know, it's just like
14 Flint, years.
Yeah,
he didn't
14
know.
Years. And like Flintstones meeting the Jetsons, imagine you like leaving with a beeper and coming back with a touchscreen, everything, So it's just a whole different world.
Who taught you? Who taught you etiquette? Who taught you technology?
Well, the technology skills I've learned from when I got involved with the Defy Ventures program. It's like an incubator for formerly incarcerated people. They believe that illegal entrepreneurs could become legal entrepreneurs, and it's an MBA like short program taught by Harvard and MBA Stanford professors. I fully took advantage of it. They hooked me up with mentors who taught me about Facebook, Instagram. I didn't know what Gmail was, none of that.
You learned your technology through that incubator.
And and then I taught myself. Like I started, watching YouTube videos, how to do this, how to do that, Googling this and that. So
three cheers for YouTube. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Do you get scared now? Is there anything you're afraid of now? And how and what role does fear play in your life, if any?
I don't get scared. Like I could walk down the streets, I could drive, and I feel, fearless of, because I'm not doing anything wrong,
A clean conscience is a good.
Oh yeah, it means a lot. It means a lot. It's true freedom. Mm.
A stamp. And a Bible. Yeah. Those are really important to you. Yeah. Why?
When I really woke up and started changing, while I was in prison and even working out, I was always even dealing, I was making my own alcohol and stuff like that and dealing drugs while I was inside. And
you are just an entrepreneurial person to the core, aren't you?
I never stopped, Sally. towards the end of my incarceration, I had about 2 months left, and this correctional officer decided to place his hands on me, and we got into a small altercation. But he quickly pressed like this like the panic button, they call it the alarm, whatever, and it sounded off the whole alarm off the jail. And once that happens, the like 10 or a dozen officers come to the scene, and they beat me up and they threw me into the cell on 24-hour lockdown, which is completely illegal. And I'm in a cell, and I was devastated because of the situation I was about to face 3 more years in prison.
So you were supposed to go home in 2 months, and now this meant 3 more years.
Yeah. And because of the situation, I did an extra year. But long story short, I was in a cell, and I wrote out a 10-page letter out to my family, letting them know I was not coming home, and to forget about whatever I was gonna do when I was out there, and I just got to do more time because of this BS. And I was playing the victim as well. I was like, this whole system is like messed up, and you know, they're completely at fault. I didn't do anything wrong. But it was not until my sister found out about a week later and told me, you know, read Psalm 91 from the Bible. She found out I was in solitary and she wrote me a letter. And when I received this letter, I threw it out inside of my bed and I was like, whatever, I'm not reading this. And I'm in this cell, which is like 105 degrees, you know, sweating. I was naked in that cell. And I decided to pick up the Bible a few days afterwards because I didn't have anything else to do. And all I had in my cell was paper, pen, envelope. And when I wrote this letter out to my family, I couldn't send it out because I didn't have a stamp to send it out with. So I was even more devastated. And I just enclosed the letter and I sat back in my cell. And then when I got that letter from my sister and she told me to read the Bible, a couple of days later, I picked it up, and as soon as I read Psalm 91, the verses that she told me to read in her letter, a stamp fell out of my Bible, and it was the stamp that I needed to send out this letter with. And I just felt like, I don't know, it was something supernatural for me.
You know what Einstein said?
Yeah.
He said, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous.
So I've never heard that. but it, and other crazy stuff happened to me while I was there. Mm-hmm. That's for some reason, every time I opened up that Bible, it felt like it was like 70 degrees. Mm-hmm. I was in the Dominican Republic on the beach. Mm-hmm. And just, I felt this whole sense of calm and peace. And I didn't feel that 100-degree weather. I didn't feel like I was in that cell anymore.
So by the time you left prison, did you still hate God, or had you made peace with him?
I've never hated him.
Angry?
I just didn't know him or believed mm-hmm. in him. Mm-hmm. But I believed after that moment that it was a higher power that I needed respect. And I say fear out of respect. And then I started, when I was in that cell, I read the Bible from front to back. And that's when I started realizing what I was doing was wrong. And it really woke me up. And I said I was not going to go back to what I used to do.
So it took you, what, 4 or 5 years to get to that point?
Yeah, about, like 3 years, yeah. Over 3 years.
And that's when you determined, I'm going to be different
yeah.
when I leave. Okay. What's a compliment that you get a lot?
Inspirational.
People tell you you're inspirational.
Yeah. A lot. And I feel blessed to have the opportunity to be told that.
It's a big compliment.
Yeah. But it's pressure.
It's a big responsibility too.
Yeah, it's pressure because it's
a big
like
responsibility. People are watching you.
Yeah, all the time, and I gotta keep going. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel like quitting, and every time I feel like that, you know, that moment that I feel like quitting, and I wake up and I'm so tired because my body hurts, and I'm like, oh, I don't want to do this, and I want a day off, and I just tell God and pray, and I tell him, you know, give me an extra hour. Give me an extra hour, and every time he answers it answers in different ways. I feel like I just look at my email and I see an email from a client saying I love the class and I can't wait to go back, or one of my trainers told me, you know, thank you so much, you know, you give me an opportunity to help my son or my family. Mm-hmm. And it means a lot.
What are your plans for your business over the next year?
I want to open up more locations, and I want to take this nationally and probably internationally. Right now with the video launch, I've been approached by investors and other people, and they ask me if I need more money, and I'm like, well, I need more money, but I think I could make my own money. and we are doing this by the video launch, so I invested we invested a lot of time and money on this video launch, and hopefully it'll generate, you know, the audience that we need to generate. So
the video is going to generate the cash flow
to
fund your growth,
fund more locations. So my whole thing is, like, if I can get, 100,000 people signed up for $5 a month, that's $500,000 a month. And I could open up a location, once a month, or whatever.
Where do you want to open up next?
We're looking at Brooklyn, and then I want to start, work by coastal, and then probably fill in between everything else. I've gotten people trying to franchise in Washington, D.C., so I'm probably going to entertain that and take a look at that. We also bought a school bus and turned it into a prison bus, and it's like a first mobile gym in the city. So we'll be running classes off the bus. So I want to do like a cross-country trip from New York to LA and hit every major urban city that's been affected by the prison, mass incarceration.
I love that idea.
Problem.
What do you wish someone would dare you to do?
I wish they'd dare me to fix this prison reform issue. And I feel like I found a way that we can disrupt the fitness industry while, solving this problem.
So consider yourself dared.
Yeah.
How are you going to disrupt yourself in the next 12 months?
I feel like I disrupt myself every day.
So you're going to disrupt yourself every day for the next 365 days?
I don't know. I just feel like I disrupt myself every day already. But it's a challenge, and I don't know how to answer that.
You did.
Yeah.
I think every day you wake up and you want to be a different and better person, you are in effect disrupting yourself. So you answered the question. Thank you so much for doing
this.
I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cause is an important person to consider when we think about disruption. Sometimes it takes constraints, and in Cause's case, imprisonment, to give yourself another chance to change. Here are my takeaways. The first is about zigging when others zag. Cause did this by realizing that when he wore his normal clothes, the cops picked him up every day. When he wore a suit, they didn't. We've all heard it shouldn't matter what you look like or how you dress or how you present an idea. Something that's worth buying into or believing in will stand on its own. Cause's experience is a sober reminder that all of us make snap judgments, rife with unconscious bias. It's not fair, but it happens. So we decide. Just like the young soccer players from Sierra Leone we learned about in episode 4, do we kick against what isn't fair, or do we do what we need to do to move forward? The second takeaway is that your strengths, they are transferable from one business to another, from one endeavor to another. For Cause, they were used to disrupt from an illegal business to a legal one. This reminds me of what Brian Moran's mom said to him in episode 3, the only security you need is between your ears. Third and finally, I was really taken by these early days of Cause's story of redemption. Every single one of us fails in big and small ways. Every single one of us has a deep-seated yearning to disrupt to a better version of ourselves. Cause's story is an archetype, a reminder that we can. As always, I love getting your questions and comments. Keep them coming. I'd love to hear about a disruptor that fascinates you. You can find me on Twitter at Johnson Whitney, or email me at Whitney@WhitneyJohnson.com. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.